the way, we introduced a quantity called eta. And with raised or lowered indices. And that might have seemed like an artificial thing to do. But in fact, it was necessary in order to get the equations into such a simple form. And the fact that this eta is not all pluses, right? This eta is minus 1, 1, 1, 1, might seem like a trivial detail, okay? But of course, the reason, but the fact that it's minus 1 is what distinguishes time from space. And so whereas, and we think about those as completely different things. Right? Space is limitless. We can travel there. We can come back. Space is freedom. But time is like this big bus which is coming down on us, and eventually it will kill us. Okay? And the reason for the difference is that minus one. So this is very, very important. Even though everything we're doing is just mathematically playing around to try to simplify equations, the physical implications are absolutely profound. But as I discussed last time, I haven't done anything, right? We just took Maxwell's equations and we just reorganized them, defined some new notation, and wrote them in a different way, in a four-component way. But the implications of this will now be clear, which is that these symmetries possess a very amazing symmetry. Okay, which is Lorentz symmetry. And so Maxwell equations possess an amazing space-time symmetry. And so what is so amazing about the Lorentz transformations is they tie time and space together. And so to see this, consider the linear transformation x alpha prime equals lambda alpha prime beta x beta. And the notation is something you have to basically get familiar with. But when you prime something, that refers to the whole quantity. So partly it refers to the index alpha. This is supposed to indicate that that index alpha is really an index within a primed coordinate system. So you'll get used to this. And then we label this. This is a matrix, a 4x4 matrix. These are the rows. This number labels the columns. And so this is just matrix multiplication. But we distinguish between the primed and the unprimed indices to kind of make it easier to remember. So what this x alpha prime means is just in components, it's ct prime and x prime. So it's the time and space coordinates in the primed coordinate system. Okay, so primed always means, prime is that little dash, prime always means in the primed coordinate system. Okay, so we're going to change from our coordinate ct and x to some other coordinate, ct prime and x prime. And this is just a generalization of rotations in ordinary space. When you rotate, so you could use the coordinates in this room, you could use that as the x coordinate, that line is the Let me do it another way around. That is the x coordinate. This is the y coordinate. That is the z coordinate. Okay? That's completely arbitrary. So you could use any coordinate system in this room, x, y, and z, as long as you draw your three axes. And then the relationship between them will be some rotation, and maybe a translation as well. That's the same idea here, except that we're rotating space into time and time into space, as well as all the other possible transformations. Then we're going to, similarly, we'll have A alpha prime. Any vector with the index upstairs will be transformed. So in particular, our four-vector potential that we defined. Remember, f mu nu was d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. So the A with upstairs indices will transform like this. The current was defined with upstairs indices. Etc. This equation for x can be inverted. So we're going to assume lambda is invertible. So we can write x beta is lambda twiddle beta alpha prime, x alpha prime. And lambda twiddle is the matrix inverse of lambda. And Carroll uses different notation, but I think this notation is quite common, and I'm going to use it. So, for example, there's a book by Schütz. A lot of students like this book, Schütz, which is a little green book in the library, and it's also called Introduction to General Relativity, I think. I believe pretty much I follow his notation. We have this equation, and then because it's the inverse, you have formulae like this, lambda alpha prime beta lambda twiddle beta delta prime equals delta alpha prime delta. Right? So lambda times its inverse, you sum the columns and the rows, and you get the identity matrix. Or you can do it the other way around, that lambda twiddle lambda alpha prime delta is delta beta delta. Okay, so lambda times its inverse is 1. Lambda inverse times lambda is also 1. And so what we get from this equation is that d by dx alpha prime, so if I take the partial derivative in the primed coordinate system, this is by the chain rule, this is dx beta dx alpha prime d by dx beta. But this dx beta dx alpha prime is just that matrix. So this is lambda twiddle beta alpha prime d by dx beta. Okay, so you see that quantities with upstairs index transform with lambda, and quantities with a downstairs index transform with lambda twiddle. Okay, so lambda twiddle has its indices arranged so that the upper one is not primed. And that will be contracted with the unprimed index to create the correct partial derivative in the primed coordinate system. So I've just defined this set of linear transformations. But now we're going to restrict them, the lambdas, to obey this equation, eta alpha beta is eta alpha prime beta prime, lambda alpha prime alpha lambda beta prime beta. Okay, and what this equation means, eta always means the same thing. Okay, eta always means the constant matrix minus 1, 1, 1, 1. And over here, this is the also the constant matrix minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay, so I can write this equation as eta is eta times lambda transpose. You see, what happened is that this row of this matrix is multiplied by the row. And that's not matrix multiplication. This is matrix multiplication, but by the transpose matrix. So eta equals lambda transpose eta lambda in matrix notation. Okay, so if I take a matrix, transpose it, and then multiply, what I'm actually doing is taking the row index and contracting the row index with the row index of that guy. And it's sometimes useful to write it in this form. So we restrict the lambdas to this by this equation. And this is completely analogous to orthogonal transformations. Okay, which are just matrices defined to satisfy O transpose O equals 1. That's the definition of an orthogonal matrix, is it satisfies one that satisfies this equation. So Lorentz transformations are basically just orthogonal transformations, but where you introduce this eta in the middle, which has the extra minus sign. So in fact, the analogy goes further, but I won't follow it. So then the question is why? Why do I restrict the lambda in this way? Because then it turns out that then any tensor equation constructed by raising and lowering indices with eta is Lorentz invariant. Okay, so any equation that you constructed this way. So if you look at these equations, you see obviously F enters here with lowered indices, but in this one it has upper indices. And the way we got the upper index guy is just by using eta. But the fact that in a sense eta is covariant under these Lorentz transformations means that the equations are Lorentz invariant. So Lorentz invariant means, i.e., if it is valid in one coordinate system, then it is valid in all coordinate systems. For some reason, we only have short pieces of chalk. Okay. So as an example, let's look at the wave equation. So the wave equation, remember, is just eta alpha beta d alpha d beta. So d alpha means d by dx alpha times some function equals 0. Okay, that is the wave equation. And this is, let's prove this is Lorentz invariant. And so what we mean by that is that if I wrote this equation in the primed coordinate system, this equation, sorry, if this equation is true in the original coordinate system, then it is true in the primed coordinate system. So let's prove that by calculating it in the primed coordinate system. Okay, so I just prime everything. But remember, eta is the same matrix in the primed system as it is in the unprimed system by definition. And now I use these formula for d alpha d beta from over there. And so this is equal to eta alpha beta lambda twiddle alpha alpha prime lambda twiddle beta beta prime d alpha d beta times the function. F doesn't have any indices, so there's no factor of lambda. So f prime equals s f. No factors of lambda. And now, so we have this equation here. Now, what is this? This is just in matrix notation, that is lambda twiddle eta, so that's row, column, and then lambda twiddle transpose, okay? Because this column is contracted with the column. And so this is really the transpose of lambda matrix multiplied. But you see, this quantity is just eta, because I had over here, lambda transpose eta lambda is eta. So if I have lambda transpose eta lambda equals eta, then just take the inverse of this equation. And when I inverse, I have to reverse the order of the matrices, right? So the inverse of the left-hand side is lambda twiddle eta. Eta is the inverse of eta. Lambda twiddle transpose equals eta. So this implies that. So this is true. And so this means that this is actually eta alpha beta d alpha d beta f, but that's 0. So if the wave equation is true in one coordinate system, then it's true in any coordinate system. Okay, and similarly, if you take these Maxwell equations and you work them out in a primed coordinate system, then this equation, the restriction on lambda here, is enough to ensure that the Maxwell equations are true. If they're true in the unprimed system, then they're true in the primed system. Notice we have an epsilon in here. So let's ask, what happens to epsilon? Okay. So notice that this equation for okay, let me first do the calculation. So if I prime this equation, epsilon is always, by definition, the tensor that is 1, if this is an even permutation, minus 1 odd, and 0 otherwise. But in the prime system, obviously all of this will change. When I work this out in the prime system, I'm going to get 3 lambda twiddles, because I've got 3 lower indices here. 3 lambda twiddles multiplying the epsilon. But there's the following identity that epsilon alpha prime, beta prime, gamma prime, delta prime, lambda twiddle, alpha prime, lambda twiddle, beta prime, lambda twiddle, gamma prime, lambda twiddle, delta prime, is epsilon alpha beta gamma delta times the determinant of lambda. Okay, so I can get rid of this lambda twiddle by just multiplying by a lambda, and that'll bring it over here. But this is the basic identity. So just to check you're familiar with this formula for the determinant, this formula is actually just the formula for the determinant of a matrix. When you work out a, so have you seen this formula that, for example, determinant of a matrix A is epsilon A, B, C, D, A, depending on the dimension of A, A1A, A2B, A3C, A4D. You familiar with that formula? Some of you are, some not. Okay, so I advise you to look at a book on linear algebra and make sure you understand this formula. The determinant, of course, you can think about it as writing all the elements out and going through all this multiplication, but it's all encoded in this formula here. Okay, so say it's a 4x4 matrix. Obviously, the determinant is fourth order in the elements of the matrix, right? Because you've got to do 4 multiplications to get the determinant. And all of that is correctly encoded in here. But in fact, you can write it a little bit more generally. Instead of picking, you can notice this formula is really a special case of a more general formula that if I put F, G, H, I as the indices there, then in fact this equals to epsilon F, G, H, I over there. Okay, so I can get rid of the 1, 2, 3, 4 and replace it with this. Why? Because the right-hand side is obviously completely anti-symmetric under changing F, G, H, or I. Because if I flip these two, I can just flip those two indices to compensate, and epsilon is odd. So this is this is a formula we'll use, which is frequently used, and basically this is just the same formula. Okay. So epsilon is almost invariant under Lorentz transformations. Okay, if I take epsilon and I Lorentz transform by the here I used the inverse because this had, well, because I'm taking the primed guy. but it's not quite because of the determinant. Okay, what is that determinant? Well, if we look at this formula here, you see the determinant of eta is just minus 1, right? So take the determinant of this equation. The determinant of the left-hand side is minus 1. The determinant of the right-hand side is the determinant. So determinant of a product of matrices is just a product of the determinants. Determinant of eta is minus 1. Determinant of lambda transpose is the determinant of lambda. Determinant of a matrix and its transpose is the same. So it's minus 1 times det lambda squared. Because you get one factor from here, one from there. So determinant of lambda is plus or minus 1. And so actually, Lorentz transformations where the determinant is plus 1 are called proper Lorentz transformations, and ones where it's minus 1 are called improper transformations. Okay, and we'll see some examples of those in a moment. But in any case, epsilon just transforms by a factor, det lambda, and so if I take the primed Maxwell equation, use this, I will simply recover the unprimed Maxwell equation, which is zero. So if the Maxwell equation is true in one coordinate system, it's true in any coordinate system. And the only thing that was important is this determinant does not vanish. But it's plus or minus one, so that's okay. Okay, so we've discovered this set of symmetries of the Maxwell equations. And let's work out some examples. I should use this, shouldn't I? Whoops. So examples of Lorentz transformations. Well, I've already mentioned one, which is just rotations. And as a simple example, let's just rotate the x and y coordinates into each other. So cosine theta, minus sine theta, cosine theta, 1. And zeros everywhere else. Okay, so if we work out what that means, it doesn't do anything to the time or z, but x prime is x cos theta plus y sine theta, y prime is y cos theta minus x sine theta. And geometrically, we have x, y, and this is theta. Sorry, drawn it badly. And theta is this angle, x prime, y prime. Okay, so if I have any point here that has coordinates x, y, then this formula will give me the coordinates in x prime and y prime. And of course, the way to figure it out is you draw a perpendicular from this point to the x prime axis, and that gives you the value of x prime. And then you draw a perpendicular here, and that'll give you the y prime coordinate, which is given by that formula above. And of course, for rotations, we have x prime squared plus y prime squared. The distance from the origin is the same in both coordinate systems. Okay, so let's do a more interesting one. And so this is called a boost. So boost mixes space and time. And so lambda alpha prime beta is cos theta minus sinh theta. Sinh theta. Cos theta. 1, 1. And zeros everywhere else. Okay, so it's like the rotation, but in fact, that's, Yeah, sorry, there's a minus here as well. Both minus. So it's that's an arbitrary choice, but I do it for a particular reason. You'll see in a moment. Notice the determinant is 1, right? Because the determinant is cos squared minus sine squared. So the determinant is 1, so it's a proper Lorentz transformation. And let's just check that this works. So write lambda eta lambda transpose. And so cosine, minus sine, cosine. And then I'll have my minus 1, 1, 1, 1. And then I'll have cosine, minus sine, cosine. Because the transpose is the same as the matrix. So now we can work this out. So the first matrix, leave it alone. Second matrix on here, all it does is going to change the sign of these two terms, minus C, S, minus S, C. And now I multiply through here, and I'm going to get minus cosine squared plus sine squared. So that is minus 1. And then I'm going to get C, S, minus S, C, so I get 0. 0, 1, 1, 1. Okay, so that's a Lorentz transformation. And the presence of the minus sign is what turned the cos into cosh. Let's put this up. Okay, so IE, CT prime is CT cosh theta minus x sine theta. And x prime is x cosh theta minus CT sine theta. Okay, so that's just writing out this equation. X alpha prime is lambda alpha prime beta x beta. And using that matrix. And of course, y prime equals y and z prime equals z. So what do these equations mean? Well, x prime equals 0. What is x prime equals 0? X prime equals 0 means the origin of the primed coordinate system, right? So the primed coordinate system is x prime, y prime, and z prime equals 0. So if I said x prime equals 0, then I can figure out where is the origin of the coordinate system. That means that x is tan theta ct from here. Just set this this to 0. So x is sinh over cos, which is tan times ct. And that, by definition, will be vt. Okay, so the origin of the prime coordinate system is moving in the unprimed system with a constant velocity, which is just tan theta times c. So it's moving with a velocity less than the speed of light, i.e. ct prime, x prime, y prime, z prime are the coordinates for an observer who moves at velocity v zero zero with respect to the unprimed coordinate system. And notice, so v is c tan theta. So as theta goes from infinity to minus infinity, v goes from 1 to minus 1. So we can draw a picture of this. Let me do it on another board. Oops. Oh, I can use that one, can't I? Yep. Oh, sorry. V over C. Right, so we can draw a picture of this, that here is our original coordinate system. And then, I'll just draw this and then explain it. So this is the line CT equals X. The X prime axis is the solution to the equation T prime equals 0. Okay? So the x prime axis is the place where t prime is 0. T prime is 0 gives the equation for the x prime axis, and that's just ct equals v over cx. Okay, so ct is some number less than 1 times x. So this is x prime, that's the x prime axis. And the t prime axis is the solution of the equation x prime equals 0. And that is just x equals vt, or ct equals x c over v. And so that's this equation. And basically, those are exactly the same equations. It's just that you treat the two axes reversed. So the diagram is completely symmetrical. So you see, what happens with a rotation is we rotate the axes. With the Lorentz transformation, you don't do that. You squish them equally. Okay. So this is the T prime axis. So essentially, the way to think about this is I could take this, the coordinate along here, that's called a light cone coordinate. This is the x equals ct is a path of a light ray. I could take that coordinate and pull it this way, just stretch, okay? And the coordinate's this way and compress it. That's the transformation. That's the picture of a Lorentz transformation. And we'll see now how this was essentially the picture of Minkowski. Okay, so Lorentz and Einstein all just used algebra. What Minkowski realized is that actually Lorentz transformations are geometrical, and there's a nice geometrical picture. And all a Lorentz transformation is drawing a different coordinate system on spacetime. Okay? So the original coordinate system, see, if I drew the coordinate grid in the x and ct coordinates, it would be like this. Here's my x, lines of constant x, lines of constant t. Okay? And then the primed coordinate system, lines of constant x, they've got to be parallel to the t prime axis. So they're instead lines like this. Sorry, lines of constant x prime. And lines of constant t prime go this way, parallel to the x prime axis. So all you're doing is covering the same space with a different coordinate system. So that was what Minkowski realized. And when you realize that, then there is no possible inconsistency in relativity. Okay? There are all kinds of papers on the internet you'll find about how, you know, there's some problem with special relativity, it's inconsistent. They're all based on algebra. And usually people make some sign mistake and find an inconsistency. But the geometrical picture makes it obvious there is no possible inconsistency. You have space-time. You have various things going on in space-time. And you can draw a grid one way or the other way or whatever. Nothing will ever create an inconsistency. Okay. So that was Minkowski's contribution. It was to realize that space-time is just an entity. And these manipulations are just different coordinate systems on space-time. Whoops. Okay, so from the it's kind of nice from this point of view to look at some examples, time dilation, Lorentz contraction, which we'll do in a moment. But one, maybe I should have pointed out, you see with this, which one is that? That's the middle one. With this interpretation, these formulae are just t prime equals gamma t minus v over c x. X prime is gamma x minus vt. Okay, so I'm just substituting v equals tanh theta in there. Use the fact that cosh theta is 1 over sec theta, and sec squared theta is 1 plus tanh, or 1 minus tanh squared theta. And so this is 1 minus v squared over c squared. And so cosh theta is 1 over square root 1 minus v over c squared. And that's gamma. OK, so yeah. Yes, must be just by dimensions. OK. So what you can notice with these transformations is that eta mu nu x mu x nu is equals eta mu prime x mu prime x nu prime. That's Lorentz invariant, because if I calculate the right-hand side, this just has two lambdas from the x primes. But lambda, lambda, eta just gives eta. So these quantities are equal. And so what that means is that x squared minus c squared t squared equals x prime squared minus c squared t prime squared. OK, so this is the Lorentz invariant interval. And you see, geometrically, all it means is that this red line is the same in both coordinate systems. Okay, that x equals ct is 0, is this line, and x prime is ct prime. But it means a little bit more, because it means that if I take my x and ct, so we'll draw the light cone. And then if I draw this curve, So this is a curve, x squared minus c squared t squared equals constant. Okay, where the constant is positive. So that's a hyperbola. At t equals 0, I have x equal to the square root of that constant. And then asymptotically, x goes to plus or minus ct. And so any, so what I have is that from this equation, the constant there will be the same in any coordinate system. So that's kind of a useful piece of information. Okay, so now we're ready to do time dilation. So let me bring that one down. So all we do is draw our picture of space-time, okay? And then we have to think, what is a clock in this space-time? So what does a clock look like on this diagram? Well, the important thing about a clock is that it ticks, and it ticks at regular intervals of time. And so all we care about are the ticks of the clock. So if the clock is at rest, it just sits at x equals 0, and it ticks all, and these ticks are space-time events. They occur at a particular place and a particular time. And so we'll label them by x. So these are ticks of the clock. So we want to know, what do those ticks of the clock look like in some other coordinate system that's moving? Well, let's draw the other coordinate system. So the other coordinate system will be ct prime, x prime. And what we have to remember is that these, so you see that the observer who lives at x prime equals 0 is moving up the ct prime axis. You have to ask, what time do they see this the clock tick? Well, they would draw a line parallel to the x prime axis, and that will be the time. So if this distance is t, that point is t, the interval of the clock ticks is capital T, then this distance here will be t prime. Okay, the length, the interval between the ticks of the clock according to this observer. Of course, that observer sees the clock moving, right? So the observer sees the clock moving to negative x prime, but the interval is t prime. Now, what's the relationship between t prime and t? Well, the one thing we know geometrically is that this quantity is Lorentz invariant, the space-time interval. And likewise, if I draw a hyperbola up here, this would be c squared t squared minus x squared equals constant. Positive constant is c squared t prime squared minus x prime squared. Okay, so what that tells me is if I draw a hyperbola through this time in the unprimed, if I draw this hyperbola, let me draw it in another color. So let's choose yellow. That hyperbola is going to come through and cross the x prime axis. And the question is, okay, so this interval here, this one here, has to be t, right? Because in the primed coordinate system or the unprimed coordinate system, that quantity is invariant. So in the, let's take it up here. In the unprimed system, x was 0. So the quantity is just c squared t, capital T squared. The prime coordinate system, I go to x prime equals 0. That's the t prime axis. It's ct prime. So you must have t prime. You must have this distance equal to t, exactly the same. So then the question is, which time, you know, is that less than? Is t prime bigger than t or less than t? It's just a geometrical question. So obviously, in my graph, I found t prime is bigger than t. But is that true? It's a very bad graph. Is it true that t prime is bigger than t? So I'll just leave that for you as a little exercise. What you can show is that actually the slope of this hyperbola equals exactly the slope of the x prime axis when it crosses the t prime axis. Okay, therefore, the slope is always less of this line than this line. Then the slope is always less than the slope of the x prime axis. And so obviously, t is less than t prime. So that means that a clock with an interval of t in a given rest frame, if I'm moving, the ticks will appear to be longer. Okay? So if I'm moving, I see you get older faster than me. Okay? And the lesson from this is if you want to keep young, you better keep moving. Okay? So it's just given this picture, it's now quite easy to work out that we have these two space-time points. So we have ct x equals 0, 0. That was the first tick. The second tick will be at ct and 0. And if we go to the ct prime and x prime coordinate, the same events, well, the first one is still at 0, 0. The second one is at gamma ct and minus gamma vt. And what matters is, and so this is equal to, so therefore t prime equals gamma t, right? Which is definitely bigger than t because gamma is bigger than 1. Okay, but I hope this gives you the picture, at least, that there's a geometrical reason for time dilation. And this is, of course, experimentally observed. The muons that enter, so when cosmic rays hit the upper atmosphere, they then create a shower of muons. And we can measure these muons. The muons have a gamma factor of 5, typically, in the atmosphere. And so they're moving relative to us. And so the lifetime, they last 5 times longer than they would in the rest frame. And so this actually allows us to detect them on the ground. If there was not for this Lorentz factor, the gamma factor, we wouldn't even observe muons in cosmic ray detectors on the ground. So e.g., mu's produced in the upper atmosphere have gammas of order 5. And so the decay rate of a muon of mu in its rest frame, or actually I should say lifetime, the lifetime of a muon in its rest frame is about 2 microseconds. And in our frame, is about 10 microseconds, and that turns out just to be enough to allow the muons to survive down to Earth to be seen in detectors. So we can do Lorentz contraction in exactly the same way. So I'll just do the diagram, and then I'll leave it to you to do the algebra. So what is Lorentz contraction? It means you take a ruler and you look at it in these two frames. So I draw my CT and X axes, and I ask, what is a ruler? Well, as a ruler is some object that goes between 0 and L in space, and then its two ends just travel forwards in time. Okay, and so that is the space-time picture of a ruler. And so all we have to do is draw our CT prime and X prime axes and ask, what does the ruler look like in those axes? Here's CT prime, here is X prime. So remember, we just have to draw so in this case, we want to ask, what is the length of the ruler in the prime coordinate system? Well, in the prime coordinate system, you would say, you know, the length is just how far it spans on the x prime axis. So this distance is L prime, right? From here to there, it's L prime. So the question is, what's the relationship between L prime and L, which is this distance from here to there? So how do we figure that out? Well, we draw our little hyperbola. So hyperbola from here will obviously go through there, right? So remember, it's asymptotically going to this 45 degrees. So clearly, this distance from here to there must be L. So this distance here must be L, because x prime squared, that's the x prime axis is where t prime is 0, right? So I just draw my hyperbola, and where it crosses is that distance is L, but L prime is, so let me try and draw this a little bit more obviously. So this distance is what we mean by L prime. Okay, but this distance from here to the origin is L. So obviously you see L prime is less than L, and that's Lorentz contraction. And if you work it out, you'll find L prime equals L over gamma. Okay, so all issues to do with special relativity transformations and so on can just be visualized as plane geometry where you change the coordinate system. Now, how are we doing for time? Is it okay if I go for another 10 minutes? Okay. Right, so now we are going to get to E equals mc squared. Okay, and I gave you out that paper yesterday, which is probably the most amazing, or one of the most amazing papers ever in theoretical physics, where Einstein inferred just from these more or less just from these arguments, that energy and mass are equivalent. So let's see. I've got to do a little bit more work to show you that. So let's consider particles. So now we want to consider a particle traveling in space-time. So we have our CT and X. And then, what do I mean by a particle? Well, a particle is this point in space, but it moves forward in time, right? It exists at all time. And so a particle is just a curve in space-time. This is the world line. Okay, so I can represent a particle by a parameterized curve. Now, the particle so at every point of the particle world line, it has a certain four velocity, okay? Or if I represent it as this parameterized curve, at every point, there is a gradient, which is dx mu d lambda, okay? The rate of change of the space-time coordinates with respect to the parameter. And if eta mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda is positive, then we say the world line is space-like. Okay, remember the this is roughly speaking minus c squared dt squared plus dx squared. If it's equal to zero, we say it's null. If it's less than zero, we say it's time-like. And so which of these three are physical particles? Pardon? The third one. Yeah, so physical particles behave like this. Massive particles. Particles. Okay? Photons are null. Photons go at the speed of light. We don't know of any particles that follow space-like trajectories. They're also called tachyons, if they exist. And they don't exist. Okay. But null and time-like particles do exist. Tachyons would cause all kinds of problems with causality. You could basically signal backwards in time if you had tachyons. So there are physical reasons why tachyons would lead to basically violations of causality. So let's concentrate on the time-like massive particles. And in fact, let's define the proper time by d tau squared equals c squared dt squared minus dx squared. So if I think about this curve, take two points. You see, the way I wrote it down, lambda is completely arbitrary. You could pick any parameterization of that curve. And physically, it's completely unimportant. Okay, the only thing that matters is the space-time position of the particle. But we can pick a particular parameterization of the curve to be the proper time. So given that the curve is time-like, then this quantity is positive. And then I can actually pick lambda, if you like. I can pick lambda so that the left-hand side is minus 1. That's just this equation, i.e. eta mu nu dx mu dx nu d tau equals minus 1. Okay, so picking a parameterization to be the proper time on the curve, you see this equation is just that equation multiplied by d tau squared. So if I pick that to be true, then this quantity is minus 1. Yeah. Sorry? Oh, yeah, good. Let's put a c squared. Sorry, I'm not always consistent about that. It shouldn't really matter. Let me just try and be careful about that. Yeah, I could do it with the C, but let me not. So let me define it this way. So what it means is that tau, the proper time, is actually measured in meters. Okay? Okay, because look, this is the way we set up the diagram. We picked our units to be meters, right? Here's x in meters. Here's time in meters, right? This is meters per second times seconds. So ct is the unit of time. And I'm going to measure, so proper time is measured in meters. Okay? So then, so tau measured in meters. Right, so now we can say, well, let u equals dx mu d tau. And that is called the four velocity of the particle. And from this equation, it obeys eta mu nu, u mu, u nu equals minus 1. And so then we'll have similarly, the four momentum, p mu will be m naught c. So m naught means the mass of the particle when it's at rest, the rest mass. I multiply by c because I want something with units of momentum. And times u mu. So u mu, even though it's a four velocity, it's actually dimensionless, okay? Because we're measuring proper time in units of space in meters. So u is actually dimensionless. U mu is dimensionless. So that's my four momentum. And notice it obeys, so this obeys p squared. Equals, so p squared is just eta mu nu p nu is equal to m naught squared c squared. And that, sorry, that's p nu. And so that's equal to minus p naught squared plus p squared. And so p naught is equal to square root of p squared plus m naught squared c squared. And so that's approximately m naught c. Sorry, what's a minus sign? Oh, yeah, sorry. Here. That's right. So Yeah, that's correct. So now I just took this on the left and this on the right and took the square. So P naught is M naught C plus P squared over 2 M naught. C plus dot dot dot. So I'm just expanding out for small p. I'm expanding that square root. And the energy no, okay, I don't need the energy at this point. And then we can work out what is the velocity of the particle. And this turns out to be P over P naught. V over C is this, which is equal to P over square root of P squared plus M naught squared C squared, which is less than 1. Modulus V over C is less than 1. Okay, so there are some, maybe I should work out the momentum too. Momentum P is gamma m naught v, and gamma is 1 over root 1 minus v squared over c squared. Okay, so these formulas are probably all familiar to you. Now I want to give you Einstein's argument about Fourier equals mc squared. Let's see, I think I need to tell you one thing. Yeah, so p naught c, so this quantity, so vector p looks like the momentum, right? This looks like the momentum. And but the question is, what is p naught? So what you notice is that p naught c is m naught c squared. That's the first term when I expand the root. It's approximately m naught c squared plus p squared over 2m. So this is the kinetic energy of the particle. Okay, if I interpret p as the momentum, then that's this is the kinetic energy. So just within the formalism, the way in which non-relativistic kinetic energy emerges is in combination with mc squared. Okay, but this is not enough to argue that the rest mass of a particle is its energy, even though perhaps it's suggestive. So rest mass, so let's just put a question mark, energy equals mc squared. So that doesn't really show it, but it maybe is a clue. And it's probably the clue that made Einstein write that paper. But the way the paper works is very ingenious, okay? And I encourage you to read it. The paper says the following. Let's imagine, so Einstein imagines a particle, okay? And imagines a particle which is going to decay by emitting two photons. So it started off with energy E naught, fact, let me draw two separate diagrams. So we started off with a particle with some energy in ought. The particle then decayed into two photons, and their energy would be, so the particle radiated some radiation in the form of two photons, one with energy half L, the other with energy half L, so two photons of equal energy. And these moved off with an angle with respect to the x-axis, an angle phi with respect to the x-axis. Okay, so the particle was just sitting there, and then it disintegrated into a lighter particle plus some plus two photons. So that was the picture. And they knew at this point in time that radiation happened, right? Because Madame Curie had discovered radioactivity. And so they knew that particles could decay into other particles. So obviously E1 is less than E0 if you conserve energy. So then all Einstein does is he says, well, let's look at this from the point of view of a moving observer. Okay? And the point is that from just the theory of electromagnetism, you can figure out that a moving, so what are these photons? They're just electromagnetic waves. That's all they are. Okay? And when you do a Lorentz transformation on electromagnetic waves, it was known what the energy, how the energy transforms. So this is in the rest frame of the particle. Okay? This is in a moving frame. So in the moving frame, the particle starts off with energy E0. But it's moving. It decays to something else with energy E1, which is also moving. And then it decays to these two photons. But what was known just from the theory of electromagnetism is that the energy of these photons was different. Okay, one of them would have an energy 1 half L, 1 minus V over C cos phi over root 1 minus V squared over C squared. And the other one would have an energy 1 half L, 1 plus V over C cos phi over root 1 minus V over C squared. Okay, so I'm just going to quote those formulae to you, but these formulae are the formula for the relativistic Doppler shift of a photon. Okay, and one of the things you could do in the examples class this afternoon is just work out those formulae. But the point is, Einstein knew the formula. He knew that if you have an electromagnetic wave with a certain energy, half L, and you move with respect to it, its energy changes in this way. And then what's the critical factor? Well, the critical factor is when you add these two numbers up, you don't get L, right? When you add this one to this one, you still have the gamma factor in the denominator. So what you say is that before, you have so before the decay, you had energy E naught. This one is in the rest frame. Here you have the moving frame. In before the decay, it has some other energy in the moving frame. He's trying to work out how much energy does it have in the moving frame. Okay, so let's just call it H naught. That's what's done in the paper, if you read it. After the decay, it has energy E1. And then you have the sum 1/2 L plus 1/2 L. Okay, that's just in this frame. Particle decayed. And so clearly by energy conservation, E naught should equal E1 plus L. Yeah?
Should the signs of the two photons' energy changes be different?
Yes. Because one is moving, they're moving in opposite directions. So if you remember the Doppler shift.
I mean, the top one should be a plus, I think, the bottom one should be minus, just because it's moving that way.
No, only this term changes. The energy is a half L. Energy is always positive.
No, yeah, I understand, but is that one getting blue shifted and the other one getting red shifted?
Yeah, so let's imagine cos phi was 1, so it's actually just traveling along the x-axis.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
And this guy's coming at you, it's 1 minus V over C over 1 plus V over C, the other one is the other way around.
Right.
One is coming at you, so it's bluer and the other one is going away. But the only point I want to make is that these formulae were known. From Maxwell and Poynting, and you can actually just calculate these things for electromagnetic waves if they're moving towards your wave. So these were known. So in the rest frame, it's kind of obvious, right? You had energy E naught, afterwards you have energy E1, and you have the two photons. In the moving frame, the surprise is, well, you have energy H1, so that's the energy of this particle. So I should call these H naught. It has energy H naught and energy H1. And then I have the two photons. So I have L over root 1 minus V over C squared. Okay, so what do I infer from this? I infer that the kinetic energy K naught is defined to be. Okay, so what is the kinetic energy of a particle anyway? Well, kinetic energy means the difference between the energy it has and the energy if it was at rest. That's what kinetic energy is. It's the energy of motion. So I take that energy in the moving frame and subtract its energy at rest. And if you take these two equations, you can see that K naught minus K1, so K1 equals H1 minus E1. K0 minus K1 equals L 1 over root 1 minus V squared over C squared minus 1. And if V is small, if V is much less than C, then that is just 1 half L V squared over C squared, if V much less than C. Okay, so what's happened is that the kinetic energy of the kinetic energy of a particle after the decay, right, is K1. This is the energy, kinetic energy before. What this is saying is that the kinetic energy afterwards is smaller than the kinetic energy before by this factor. Now, how can you explain that? How did this particle suddenly lose its kinetic energy? The only way it can do that is if it lost mass. Right? The kinetic energy was a half mv squared. Kinetic energy is always a half mv squared. And yet afterwards, you find that the half mv squared has changed. So it must be that the mass has changed. You know what V is, because this is at rest in this original frame. This frame is moving at velocity phi. So velocity of the particle here must be V. And so the only way for the kinetic energy to change is if the mass has changed. So the conclusion is that if you radiate some light, your mass changes. And that means, so the title of the paper, I can't remember, but the title of the paper is, does the inertia of a body, the inertia means the m I put into kinetic energy, half mv squared, does the inertia depend on its energy content? What he's discovered is if it radiates some energy, its inertia changes. Okay? So, and then basically the implications of this were enormous, as you know. Then you realize that when particles radiate energy, their mass changes. Therefore, you could ask immediately, aha, well, if I have a bunch of nuclei which are unstable and they radiate energy, and they transform from one element to another, how much energy is going to be released? And of course, that was the origin of nuclear power, nuclear bombs, and all of that. So, but you can see it's an incredibly simple argument. The only thing I've kind of just thrown at you are these formulae. But as I say, these were well known from electromagnetism, and they're rather easy to derive. For the relativistic Doppler effect is rather easy to derive just using momentum conservation and relativistic invariance. And we could do that in the example class this afternoon. Okay, are there any questions? Yeah?
I think we have a minus sign.
Sorry?
I think we should have a minus sign in K0 minus K1.
No, K naught was the initial kinetic energy.
So it should be less than. Oh, okay.
No, K1 is the final kinetic energy. It's lost mass. Okay, so this is equal to 1/2. If the velocity is small, this is 1/2 m naught v squared. Okay, that's the initial rest mass. K1 is the 1/2. M1 v squared. And so what this is saying is that this is saying that M naught minus M1 equals L over C squared. So the change in the mass is equal to L over C squared. So, of course, you know, he's assumed energy conservation. But that's about all. And he has this lovely line at the end of the paper. Okay. This really makes you feel small, this paper. It says, if the theory corresponds to the facts, radiation conveys inertia between the emitting and absorbing bodies. Okay. So this is just a conjecture, but it's a funny story. Okay, see you next time.